From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 799, The Rise of Ransomware with guest Ann Johnson. Recorded Monday, August 23rd, 2021. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Bringing back my guest today, Corporate Vice President of Cybersecurity Solutions at Microsoft, Ann Johnson, who oversees the go-to-market strategies of cybersecurity and compliance solutions for one of the largest tech companies on the planet. It's a race to see which one's largest, but in the trillion-dollar club, and it's a very small club. How are you, Ann?
No worries at all. Thank you so much for having me. And it is a very small club, though. We don't focus on that. We want to focus on our customers.
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's your shareholders who do a lot of that anyway. But I think it also speaks to just how important technology has been this past year, if not all these years. But you know, when we talked in the midst of the early days of the pandemic, I really appreciated your thinking about the security issues. I'm just staggered in the past few months at the detonation of ransomware, or maybe we're just hearing about it more. What do you see? Is ransomware worse, or is it just being talked about?
You know, let's take a step back.
Sure.
Let's think about the evolution of ransomware, and then we'll come to where we are today, mm-hmm. right? So if you think about there's small pockets that started, you know, we can trace it back to things like CryptoLocker in 2013. Mm-hmm. And this really was that start of a surge for opportunistic, a single way to monetize cybercrime. You know, the term we're learning now, right? Cybercrime.
Yeah.
Then you think about some of the wholesale events that, you know, started with things like, you know, even though NotPetya or WannaCry weren't necessary ransomware events, they showed how destructive large-scale events could be. And the mm-hmm. ransomware operators who, you know, we know these cyber criminals are at least maybe they're not endorsed by nation states, but there are nation states giving, you know, turning their blind eye to them and not really enforcing things. So we've seen this increase steadily from 2013 all the way through to June of 2019. And then in June of 2019, we saw this new attack method that really became ransomware. And human operator ransomware changed the game because they can go into an environment and do targeted, specific attacks, even at a departmental level, and then try to monetize those departmental level attacks. And it's hands-on keyboard type folks. So they're actually being really specific. And this whole concept of proof of life. And, you know, if you don't pay us the data, if you don't pay us the ransom, here's all your data that we're going to release to the public. And it's either going to be embarrassing data or it's going to be, you know, a regulatory violation, so you better pay us. Then you take into fact like the cyber insurance companies, right? Mm-hmm. The ransomware actors know that cyber insurance is going to pay off. So you're seeing 40, 50, you know, $60 million payoff requests. All that stuff has certainly made, you know, ransomware more prevalent. It's hard to, you know, quantify. Are there more? Are there less? But they're certainly more visible. We believe it's growing. And it's certainly a growing threat because the attack surface, you know, for the ransomware actors is growing via human operator ransomware. And the outcome and the payouts are growing because right. they know there's someone backstopping them, right?
Well, isn't that a classic line from a criminal, too? It's like, hey, this you've got insurance. This isn't going to cost you anything. Just do it. Which is, I mean, it's not true. There's always a victim here, one way or the other, least of all disrupted operations. But theft is theft. You're stealing money or you're extorting money.
Yeah. You're extorting money. And there's, you know, it goes back to the old joke, right? Why do criminals rob banks? That's because where the money is.
Right.
It's why do criminals launch ransomware attacks? Because they know they're going to get paid.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they're, and the most egregious and horrific ones were the ones that took down hospital operations during the pandemic.
Yeah.
They knew those hospitals were going to pay because they had to, you know, deliver patient services. So these are not good humans, right, that are launching these attacks.
No.
And the fact that they're saying, well, we're going to keep certain things out of scope or we're not going to go here or it's too much bad PR, we're going to close down operations. I think those are all disingenuous type statements.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of this, I feel like they've gotten to a certain size where the best of the white hats, the FBI's cyber security group, Microsoft, other organizations have gotten involved. And the big ones seem to be getting rolled up. I look at what happened to the Colonial Gas attack, and it's like, hey, there's a downside to being a big player. The big good guys come for you.
There is, but I think there's a misconception in the industry. A lot of these bigger players, when you think about things like the Colonial, is actually ransomware as a service.
Wow.
So the bigger players are actually, yeah, they're delivering ransomware capability, mm-hmm. but there's a whole lot of smaller players executing with the capability of ransomware as a service. And so there isn't some big monolithic, you know, ransomware network typically. It's a lot of smaller players, and there's a lot of between the thieves, right? There's some type of trust level between them.
Which, yeah, it's always interesting to consider trust level between the thieves. But of course, as a service model is pretty arm's length too. I think you can do quite a bit in that respect. The question is, in some ways, do you just go after the service provider then more than the particular criminals that are using the services?
Well, you know, we've had success through our digital crimes unit of doing, you know, bot takedowns, like botnet takedowns.
Right, I remember.
We interrupted trick bot operations for a period of time, right? So if you can go after the actual service providers, no matter where in the ecosystem they sit, but the ransomware supply chain, then you're going to have to be a lot more effective than potentially going after the cyber criminals who truly are hidden and, like I said, may even be, you know, somewhat, you know, unofficially sponsored, because we also see the cyber criminals outsourcing for nation states. So they will do things like a nation state will pay them to get access to an environment, and they'll monetize the attack that way. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, while I'm in here, I'll do some ransoming so I can make more money this way. So there's definitely a relationship between the cyber criminals and nation state actors in a lot of cases. So taking down their supply chain and their infrastructure is usually a pretty good way to go.
And we're recording this in late August, where I just saw that the Hafnium exploits that put backdoors into a lot of exchange servers, which was all patched months ago if you did the patches, are now being exploited. From the ones that aren't patched have been being exploited for ransomware. So it's almost like that Hafnium exploit sure looked like a sort of state actor espionage attempt that then got covered up in a broader exploit. Like, they were after specific data, then they broke a whole bunch of other machines to make it confuse as to what they were after, and then left all the back doors in for everybody else to follow afterwards to take advantage of those that weren't cleaning up the mess.
Which is pretty common. And, you know, one of the reasons that led to our acquisition of a company like RiskIQ was so we had that surface management, right? We could actually see the attack surface. They gave us a lot of incredibly valuable data during the Hafnium event. And I will say also that, you know, one of the things, and I don't want to in any way be negative, but you have to really do a cost analysis of your actual business continuity of why you're running an exchange farm on premises at this point in time.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, because we know the exploits are out there. We have pretty good visibility into, you know, the customer's ability to patch. And I'm not criticizing customers. They have a lot of technical debt, right? So of all the things you could potentially move to the cloud, you know, Exchange would be first in line for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah. No, I can't argue with you there. And it certainly put a lot of pressure on a lot of folks. It does feel like it's the old installations of Exchange that didn't get patched and are being exploited now. And all the more reason that those pieces should be moving to the cloud. I'm scared of perverse incentives too, like that that shouldn't be a marketing strategy. It's not the way to go about things.
It's not because there are some legitimate reasons for customers who are still staying on premises, but then you need to understand the security around that environment. And, you know, it's absolutely would not want to encourage someone, you know, through a sales or marketing technique to move, but they need to understand the reality of their ability to protect those on-premises infrastructure. And are they really required? And if so, then what are you going to do to keep them safe?
And what the overhead, what the scope of responsibility is, maybe that's what's happening this year. We just spent a year really finding out how dependent we were on infrastructure and our IT people. Certainly the conversations I've had in the show the past year and a half have been like that. And now we're finding out the scope of the responsibility of that too, that if you're going to run this stuff, you have to take care of it, that there are criminals out there who are looking or checking your doors all of the time.
You do. And it's, you know, it's like your home, right? You have locks on the doors and you have a security system. cameras. It's defense in depth. Yeah, we've talked about defense in depth and security for years. You can't just have one tool. You need to have layered defense in depth. And it's all based on a risk assessment, right? How risky is the environment you're trying to secure? Plus, what are the assets within that environment? I mean, I would pay any amount of money to keep my family safe in my home.
Sure.
What type of data in your environment is worth any amount of money, right? What is it that's critical business systems that you must have the business online? Where is that data? And then how do you actually secure that in a way that, you know, it's your business will continue to operate even if you have a ransomware attack?
I'm also beginning to appreciate that there's this network effect that you may be a conduit into a more valuable company. And so it's not that they're exploiting you to get to your data so much as they're exploiting you for your relationship with someone else. And that's a whole other set of math to be done about what our risks actually are.
We continue to see that, right? Yeah. We continue to see these type of supply chain attacks where we're going to, you know, think about just like Pulse Secure, right? Mm-hmm. Think about anything you've seen in the news. Think about the Nobelium attacks, right? We're going to attack a particular provider or a group of providers, by the way, because we want access to some type of end user data, whether that's in a government or a private company organization. And that's a supply, you know, the number one and two questions I get from customers right now are about supply chain and about ransomware.
Right.
How do I protect my supply chain? How do I know my supply chain secure? And how do I protect myself against a ransomware attack?
So do you see the sort of end game customer taking this on, that they are now going to start questioning all of the vendors that that effectively have products that have privileges in their organizations to understand that that supply chain is secure?
I think that, you know, the advice I have for customers on supply chain isn't always what they want to hear, right? Mm-hmm. You certainly need to have the right level of rigor and auditing and controls for your supply chain vendors, right? You certainly do not want to in any way to let them, you know, give them a pass on anything. But at the end of the day, if someone's going to come into your environment, no matter how they come in, the onus is on you to secure your environment.
Right.
And to think about all the different entry points and make sure you're doing things like using multi-factor authentication. I say it all the time. You've heard me say it all the time.
Yes.
You know, MFA for all your users all the time. And we've taken the friction out of the MFA, right? You're not talking about rolling out hardware tokens anymore. Biometrics and authenticators, things that people are used to using in their consumer world. You can take those into enterprise, so it's the same look and feel and user experience.
Yeah, and I think about standards like PCI DSS for credit card processing. That's supposed to give me confidence that you're handling credit card data correctly. It's like, do I want to have some kind of certification before I'll allow a vendor's products into my network? Although I guess with defense in depth, it shouldn't matter, should it?
Well, I think it's a risk decision, right? Mm-hmm. I do think you have to have defense in depth, but you also need to make sure your vendors are meeting a minimum set of, you know, security. And you can't, you know, it goes back way back to Target, right? That was our first
classic.
That just because you're compliant, you're not secure. And you know, just because an organization is HIPAA compliant or PCI compliant or whatever compliance, SOX, GLB, you name it, does not mean they're secure. And you can't rely on that. It's a minimum standard.
And wasn't the Target attack effectively a supply chain attack? Was it like a piece of HVAC software that was the exploit into the perimeter and it sort of went from there? do we call it a supply chain attack?
Yeah, that could be supply. Look, the RSA security attack, right?
Right.
And, you know, we were very public that the RSA security attack was RSA. You know, it was one of the first instances of someone wanting to steal our tokens so they could get into our customers, right? They wanted the seed records for the token. But that was also, that attack was actually an Excel macro attack. That was an interesting attack because it was an attack where they used they were getting into a, I don't want to go into detail I shouldn't go into, but they were basically launched an email with an Excel attachment that had someone clicked on that link because they thought it was something part of their job, right? And it was a vendor thing. And, you know, that suddenly launched the enterprise in seconds, you know, minutes, right? Yeah. All of those things are still, you know, that was 10 years ago. All of those things we see are still prevalent. Still see a lot of Cobalt Strike, and we see Mimikatz, and we see, you know, Process Hacker, you know, and then we just see the basic phishing attacks. Phishing is still the number one way people launch ransomware attacks, but it's going down in prevalence because people are getting better about phishing. Mm-hmm. So the attackers are getting more sophisticated with their attack vectors.
And I'm going to interrupt for one moment, Anne, for this very important message. You know you need to implement Zero Trust for your Windows 10 machines, but where do you start? Between users with too many privileges and threats from ransomware and unsanctioned USB sticks, you need a system that works quickly to secure your Windows endpoints. Don't be the IT admin that could have done something, but didn't. Block the badness and ensure that you have enough permissions to use Policy Pack on your work from anywhere Windows 10 machines. With Policy Pack, you get a zero-trust implementation system to manage your applications and browsers on Windows 10, overcome application UAC prompts, remove local admin rights, block unknownware, and mitigate threats from USB and other removable media. As a bonus, you can use Policy Pack to deliver any real on-premises group policy and group policy preferences settings to your remote work machines for the security and configuration they need. Learn how thousands of other admins enhance their remote work scenarios. Come to policypack.com to learn more and start a free trial. That's policypack.com. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. This is Ann Johnson. We're talking a little bit about the cybersecurity world as it stands today and Microsoft's role in it and this challenge of ransomware. And I certainly appreciate before the break, we're talking about this increasing sophistication. Like I'm looking at how clever business email compromise has gotten where they know all the players inside of an organization. They know exactly how to express themselves that mid-level people are being fooled, that the boss is asking them to do something that involves moving money abruptly and huge sums are being stolen.
Yeah, so business email compromise. I'll tell you a little bit of an anecdote. Before I came to Microsoft, I was the CEO of a little VC-funded startup, and one day I was in the office, and my CFO, you know, the person who handled the books for the company, sent me an email and said, "Hey, do you really want me to send this money?" And it turns out someone had spoofed me, it looked like me, and asked him to send money to a bank account, a substantial amount of money. And I said, no, and I'm glad you asked, you know, because he was thinking about doing it. But here's the interesting part about that. I went through the whole process of calling, and I won't say who it was, calling that bank. It was a smaller regional bank, trying to get them to care.
Yeah.
And they didn't. I said, here's the account number that they were trying to put money into. This account could, I don't know what this account's being used for, but right now it's being used for criminal enterprise. And I just couldn't get them to care.
That's really
so
interesting.
There's a whole supply chain when you think about, you know, even that, the whole ecosystem that's impacted all has to jointly care. I think that we've become, you know, in the past 5, 6, 7 years, much more sophisticated, right? The FBI has really great, you know, cyber operations. Mm-hmm. We're getting really great cyber operations in all levels of government. And I think that's, you know, people, and I do think it's an awareness. I guess if there's, you know, I said this and I hate to say it, but it's true. Like if attacking, you know, the U.S. oil supply and a meat supplier is the one thing we had to do to get the attention of everyone around how bad of a problem this is, then so be it. No one seemed to care when hospitals were being attacked all of last year, and they were being attacked a lot last year. And we couldn't, you know, you couldn't get the issue above the line, right? Just couldn't get it raised above the line. So we're in a period of time now where the issue is raised above the line. Now we need real solutions.
Yeah. The moment somebody couldn't get a tank of gas, then we cared. Yeah. Then we called our congressman. Yeah. Like that's what it took.
But you know what? So be it.
Okay.
But now, now that it's above the line, we need to take action, right? We need to take real action.
It occurs to me, you know, comparing that banking scenario, remember when identity theft was a huge crisis? And then it seemed like all the banks got savvy to identity theft. And suddenly when you said those words, "I'm afraid my identity has been stolen," they all had procedures, you know, and suddenly it became less of a crisis. And I think the thieves moved away from it because it wasn't being successful because we executed so well on defending against it.
And that's a great example. One of the things we talk about with ransomware, by the way, is cyber resilience. Mm-hmm. You need a cyber playbook that's exactly the same playbook as if you had a physical or natural disaster at your company. Who are you calling? What systems are you bringing back online? How are you getting back online? What's your PR, your comms, your regulatory, your communication method, et cetera? And you need to publish that and you need to test it. You know, just a simple thing is making sure you can restore from your backups and making sure those backups aren't in line to the ransomware attack, that they're actually out of band in some way, they're offline or they're in the cloud or wherever they are. Simple things like that. What you want is these playbooks, just like the playbook you were talking about with identity theft. You want these playbooks so people don't have to think. People are in crisis. You don't want them thinking. You want them acting. You want them going through the first 10, 20, 30 steps.
Yeah, until they settle down enough that they can think a little. But you're right. That in case of book is all about doing the right things at the beginning, not making it worse. And and getting the panic level down, because you don't even know what to do. You know the procedure to follow.
Correct.
And that's what's really going to suck the air out of this ultimately, is when the ransoms stop being paid because they don't need to be paid.
Yeah, and the ransomware actors have figured out, right? Mm-hmm. They figured out that companies are learning that they need to be able to restore from their backups. And that's where we're getting to the, okay, well, we're going to steal some data. And then with that data, we're going to embarrass you publicly, or we're going to violate, you know, have you violate some type of regulation by releasing that data or selling it to the dark web. So that whole, you know, I did a webinar not that long ago, a couple months ago, that talked about, you know, when we used to call it information security, and we did a whole lot of data encryption, and we thought about not just encryption at rest, but encryption in transit, and we a little bit more about DLP. We actually need to get back to that type of stuff too, because that ability for the operator or the bad, you know, the bad actor to steal data, we want to reduce the ability for them to do that. The whole thing is about raising the cost to the attacker. The more expensive we make it, the worse their ROI. They're going to stop doing ransomware. They're going to move on to something else, but we can at least get ransomware under control.
The other question I asked a group of IT folks that were dealing with this particular issue was not only that we had valid backups, but did you actually know how to restore them? Like, could you go bare metal, blow out all these machines? And how long will it take? Like, what order would you do things in? How long is it going to take to come back up? Because all too often, they got all the right people in the room and they're like, okay, if we have to go from scratch, how long does this take? And they don't know the answer.
Well, that's the, so here, I'll give you a little bit of history. Before I ever did security, I called Data General. And we did storage. And all we did was storage. We got acquired by EMC along the way. So I have a lot of historical knowledge of the fact that most companies at the time just back up to meet some type of PCI compliance or some type of compliance. They never even tested their ability to recover. So they just wanted the backup in a certain window to not interrupt operations and meet compliance of whatever backup, where data they had to retain for whatever period of time based on records retention.
Right.
Now we're telling people you need to test that you can recover those backups. I don't care how the backups are done. People are still backing up on tape, oddly enough. But I don't care how you're backing up. You need to test that you can recover.
What I like about backing up on tape, especially if you've got long rotations, is that that's not likely to get corrupted by the ransomwares. Like, they don't get a digital access to it. It's a physical thing that's offline.
That is, there are some upsides to backing up your super sensitive critical data or back up your domain controllers in that manner. But, you know, if you're working with a storage company, they're going to walk you through all the different scenarios and all the things available to you, right?
Right.
And I just, the main thing I want to say is test that you can recover. It's not enough to back up. To your point, how long is it going to take you to recover that domain controller so you can get your exchange back online?
And bringing HR back up first so that everybody can still get paid, like, definitely a sentence of order of procedure so that the right things are in place and in a sufficient to get, you know, I think it's also this idea of how long does it take to get operational enough? Like, everyone I've talked to who's actually gone through a ransomware attack, you're down at least the best, even paying, we're still down a week.
So I'll give you a couple examples with, of course, not naming the companies. One I can name because they were super public about it. For Maersk, right? They had to pay a competitor to move cargo.
Right.
So you never want it, because they had no system to even move a ship by using a piece of paper with a signature. They had just gone away from all of that. So understanding that part of business operation, and then another entity we're involved with, exactly right. They said, I don't care what you do, we get payroll online. Whatever you do, make sure we can pay our people.
Right.
So it's understanding the order of priority of the systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what's interesting is we've always just said that, can you restore? And that's not enough information. That is, what is the order of restore? How long does each piece take? You know, where are we going to get into crisis? The other part of this is, of course, if you lost the gear, like, I was doing a lot of hurricane scenarios. So the building has been destroyed by the hurricane. Doesn't matter how much, you know, there was a limit. It's like, at this level, we're going to lose the building. What does the restore procedure look like then? And then it was ordering gear, like just physically getting enough hardware into play and how long that was going to take. I just don't know that people think about that stuff anymore. Of course, the cloud compensates, doesn't it?
In a way, but even your cloud, there's on-premises dependencies, right? And again, it's but having the playbook, right? Having that written out, documented, tested, the right people, you know, the call chain, you know, the order of restoration, you know, who's going to be engaged. You even know what vendors, right? I need to, you know, maybe my payroll's ADP, and maybe I'm in the Microsoft cloud, and maybe I'm using Salesforce for CRM, whatever. Knowing your order of vendors and who the vendor contact is too has to be part of that playbook.
Right. Very interesting. I do want to talk a little bit about this. How do we stop these attacks from happening at all? And And it's funny, Zero Trust has come up a lot lately as we've been talking about doing more work in the cloud and finding out the one thing you can't do on the cloud is dial security down. Like, you guys just don't let us do that. That old tactic of, well, we'll turn the security off, try this stuff, make sure it works, and then we'll dial the security back on, just isn't an option in the cloud.
Yeah. So here's the deal. Cloud is configurable, right? We're going to give you best practices. We're going to give you a reference security architecture, and we're going to tell you the impact of the decisions that you make. But if you truly have zero trust in your environment, if you're using multi-factor for 100% of your users 100% of the time, which is one of our core tenets of zero trust, if you're using least privilege, which is another core tenet, right? Then you can't elevate privileges. One of the things we see in enterprises still today is there's just way too much privilege, including admin privilege for everybody who has an endpoint, including your admins. Like, people don't understand how much rights HR admins have, right? So suddenly HR admins get compromised. And then the third core tenet is explicitly verifying everything that happens in a session. Every transaction in the session needs to be verified, whether it's a user, device, data, et cetera. That's zero trust. Those three things: MFA, least privilege, explicit verify. And if you do those three things, you're going to reduce the ability of someone to get lateral movement in your environment, and you'll catch them earlier.
Right.
When you say stopping ransomware, though, there's a whole economic model that needs to be disrupted. There's a whole public-private partnership thing, and there's just putting pressure on the entities that are actually harboring these cyber criminals. All that has to happen. It's not just a technological solve.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I find it funny to see folks saying, well, should we make it a crime to pay ransomware? And I just, does that have any credence at all? It seems foolish to me.
You know, I guess I would ask them, go sit in one of those companies that's been ransomed and has to make payroll and tell them they can't pay the ransom.
Yeah.
We don't ever advocate for anyone to pay ransom, because we know that only about 50% of the time, 50 to 70% of the time, do you get keys that are going to work to restore all your data. But at the end of the day, if you're a company that's just crippled and you have no other mechanism and you don't have backups to bring back online, you really may have no other choice. So I don't want to be the person making those decisions, nor do I want law enforcement making those decisions.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. And bigger part here is just keep yourself in a place where you don't need to pay the ransom.
Yeah.
It isn't actually the only route.
Yeah, that's it. And we talk a lot about digital empathy and being one of the things, and there's a lot of computer professionals, security professionals I've talked to, we need to stop embarrassing companies who've had an event, because we want companies to be more transparent about their events. So we learn from their events so that we can stop the events. And we always attack, right? Oh, ha, 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 look what happened to that, folks. Just having just some fundamental empathy would be helpful.
Yeah, listen, we're all in pretty glass houses around here. Come on.
We are. I am never going to be a person that criticizes, like I said, the living, if I didn't know better anyway, living through RSA's breach. So here's a security company that just got, owned for all intents and purposes. Trust me, I will never be criticizing anybody.
Yeah. And just the empathy, it helps to have been there too, but it shouldn't be a prerequisite to have been there.
Correct.
Things happen. I do believe everybody goes to work trying to do their best.
So do I.
Whether they have all the skills or all the time or all the opportunities is a different question. But, nobody has bad intent here per se, except those black hats. And I'm really resisting calling them hackers anymore, because I think hackers are still too friendly. They're criminals.
They are cyber criminals, or they're doing cyber espionage, or, I'm really reticent to use the word cyber warfare, but we'll probably get there at some point.
Yeah. Well, one would argue there has been some cyber warfare going on. It's just, nobody wants another Pearl Harbor or 9/11. And we don't need that one example. Then there's always the argument is that's already happened, that Colonial Gas was one of those, or I don't know which you want to spin it there, but clearly, as long as these things are profitable, they're just going to keep getting bigger.
Correct. That's the old, why does Jesse James rob banks? Because that's where the money is.
Yeah, that's where all the money is. So you are working at another level too. Like, I'm here in the trenches with other devs and IT folks. We're just trying to fight the thing out there. But it's nice to know not only you're helping us and giving us good guidance around those little things, but you're having conversations at higher levels about how we do squash this business, this criminal enterprise overall, or at least put more dents in them.
Yeah. And I think, you want to talk at the dev level, right? Just all the way, you'll hear the shift left or the CICD going all the way to just having better tools so you can develop, less vulnerable code, right? We need to make sure that we're giving you better capabilities, because at the end of the day, a lot of these things or compromises from vulnerabilities that were originally coded in software and haven't been patched, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, some of the things you saw the print nightmare stuff, you know, some of that goes back a really long time, you know?
Well, and we're still fighting that. You know, I'm going to end up doing a whole show just on print nightmare because it genuinely is a nightmare for certain groups of folks. I've seen now there's certain big enough organizations that have configuration manager that are now building templates to deal with it. And small organizations are doing internet that way. And I still have a group of folks that are fighting, struggling. And we're looking at group policy answers and it's very interesting. As soon as the print nightmare thing came up, there was, you know, it's weird that we normally do not allow users to install drivers, except for printers. Why do printers get a pass? Why do we expect users to choose printers when we normally dictate all of that?
You know, was that in security is often the trade-off between usability, productivity, and security.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. It's always the trade-off. So
yeah.
It was more the point-and-click folks or the point-and-print folks that had bigger issues, right? And again, those were trade-offs that were made at some point in time with the those are older vulnerabilities, and the decisions were made with the knowledge we had at the time.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, looking at 2021 lens, they're not the right decisions. But
no.
The other thing I would say is that just getting the devs to a place where we can faster, more automated ways to make sure that your code doesn't have vulnerabilities.
Yeah. And making it easier for programmers to develop in least privilege, because it's not easy to do that right now.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think, again, like this, not to keep cheering about the cloud, but cloud makes security non-optional. You end up having to climb over this bench of security requirements before you can do anything. And that seems to be helping, I think. And a change of pace.
Yeah. And it will continue to help, right? And I love it because you do have to deliberately choose not to do something as opposed to deliberately choosing to do something.
Do something, yeah.
Right? You have to say, I'm going to turn this off. And then it's like, well, why are you turning this off?
Yeah. Well, and I do think, and this is an ongoing conversation, changing the super user accounts, the administrator accounts, making them no longer personal, that they're role accounts that you do for a particular role, and that's the only time you're in them. Just because I feel like sysadmins are becoming the exploit vector now, because the domain accounts are pretty locked down.
They are. And the one thing you need to do is have them also least privilege, only available when needed. And they need to be secure admin workstations. They need to be workstations that they're not doing their day-to-day work on.
Yeah.
Well, they absolutely must be.
I'm starting to really appreciate the idea that administrator accounts don't have access to email and browsers. That's a domain account thing.
That's correct.
If you need email and browser, be in your, and when you need to do both at the same time, well, good news. You're an IT guy. You can have two machines. One logged in your domain account and one in the admin account that you're doing what you're doing on. So it is an interesting balance. And it certainly, I guess we're going to have to keep ringing the bell on that one. And I really appreciate your time on this and making time for us to talk about these hard problems. I feel like it's going to get better, but it's not a good day today. It hasn't been a good day for a while in cybersecurity, it seems.
Thank you so much for allowing me to come on. And I just hope someone gets some value out of this conversation, because that's what we're here for.
I hope so, too. And the podcast is Afternoon Cyber Tea?
Yes, I should promote Afternoon Cyber Tea, my podcast. We're launching season 5 in October. We have an exceptional guest lineup, and I'll start doing the promotion soon, but I'm really excited about the guests that we have committed so far.
Awesome. I'll include show links in the show notes. And Johnson, thanks so much for coming on the show again. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.